like to read part of our story one more time. Meanwhile, Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any who belonged to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now, as he was going along and approaching Damascus, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Saul asked, "Who are you, Lord?" The reply came, "I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But get up and enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do." The scene from the book of the Acts of the Apostles is one of the more well-known of the New Testament, and especially if you're talking about the stories outside of the Gospels. And as rich and as visceral as this passage about Saul on the road to Damascus is, there is so much more to this story and so much more that matters to us this morning. Because what we just heard is actually only one half of the story. For after the men that were with the blinded Saul led him into Damascus, we actually have a second strand to this story. There was a disciple of Jesus in Damascus named Ananias. And Ananias also has a vision from God, where he is told to go to the street called Straight, to the house of Judas, and to look for a man called Saul. And he is also told that at that moment, Saul himself is experiencing a vision. And in Saul's vision, Ananias is going to heal him so that Saul will regain his sight. Now, at this point in the story, you should know that Ananias, he will kind of balks. And he balks at the Lord. And he does this with good reason. For you remember at just a bit ago, the beginning of this portion from the Acts of the Apostles began. Meanwhile, Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. Do you remember that part? Well, Ananias does too. And so I think this is a moment where it is really important to get deeper into what Ananias might be experiencing. You heard referenced letters from the high priest in Jerusalem. Well, it is possible that one of the letters from the high priest that Saul was bearing with him, well, it may just have had Ananias' name on it, so that he could be bound and brought to trial in Jerusalem. There is no doubt that those letters had the names of Ananias' friends, maybe even his family. So what Ananias was being asked to do in this vision was nothing other than to walk into the house of his religious bounty hunter and to lay hands upon his head. But rather than strangle him, he was being asked to heal him. Now, what follows in these next few verses are that something like scales falls from Saul's eyes, and it's some of the more famous words that we know in this story. But there are two words that precede this action, words that Ananias uses, and they are just as powerful. So back to this story, because remarkably, Ananias agrees to follow this vision. He goes to the street called Straight, and he walks up to the house. The house of his enemy. Can you imagine the trepidation he must have felt? Have you ever had to walk into the room of someone who knows themselves to be an enemy of yours? Someone who has sworn to do you harm? It might be something like a member of the French Resistance walking into the house of an SS officer to heal them. Or, more current to our day, a Syrian entering the home of a leader of Daesh. What thoughts were racing through Ananias' mind? What faith compelled him to trust in this vision? What he was thinking, we can only imagine, but what he said has been recorded for us to hear. For when Ananias reaches the home and finds his blinded persecutor stretched out in front of him, he reaches out his hands, and his first words are, "Brother Saul, Brother Saul, the Lord Jesus who appeared to you on your way here has sent me so that you may regain your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit." It is then that scales fall. But Brother Saul, did you catch that? He calls out to his persecutor as kin. Do you follow? What Saul cannot see, Ananias does. And even as Saul, right, is this primary and sometimes singular figure in the telling of our early Christian story, it is clear here that Saul is not meant to do this on his own. Saul is given a vision, and Ananias is given a vision that they each might find each other and see. And yes, that part about Saul being knocked to the ground by the blinding light is metaphoric and it is dramatic. But biblical scholar Matt Skinner reminds us that the act and the utterance by Ananias is actually critical to what is a paired narrative. It's one of several in the book of Acts where two people, each one receives a revelation, and they have to find each other in order that they can work it out. But this isn't just a very interesting literary device. It's actually an embodied reminder of God's mission of reconciliation that demands partners, conspirators, family. Now, I'm sure that Jesus could have imparted knowledge to Saul in a way that didn't involve other people. That blinding flash could have been a vision Saul alone figured out. But that's not how the Comforter, the Reconciler, works. This way of Jesus, whether on the road to Damascus or in the navigation of intra-office power struggles or in a long-simmering family conflict, this way is not intended to be a solo climb. In all the trials that kill the body or deaden the soul, as followers of the risen one, we are to share this road and share it with the most unlikely of fellow travelers. Which brings us to the shores of Lake Tiberias, to a chapter of the Gospel according to John that was not written by John. Now, I realize that for some Christian traditions, what I just said might count as heresy, but at the very least, for the followers of Christ that have been part of the Roman Catholic and Orthodox and Anglican tradition, we have come to know these sacred texts as a result of human authors who have received divine inspiration. And so it's why in some translations this chapter of John's Gospel is referred to as the epilogue, Right? It was clearly appended at some point after the creation of this gospel. And so the question that I've been wondering this week is, why is it here? Why do we feel that we need to read it? If the early followers of Jesus the Christ didn't feel that we had all the story we needed, what was it that was missing? What truth still needed to be told? Well, at first it might be helpful to explore the stage that the author has set for us. For instance, why is Peter fishing on the Sea of Tiberias, also known as the Sea of Galilee? You may remember that the end of the previous chapter, what we heard last Sunday, was, and what was probably actually at some point the end of the Gospel of John, last week we were in Jerusalem, in the upper room with Thomas proclaiming Jesus as his Lord and his God. But here, in this chapter, some period of time after the resurrection, maybe it's days, maybe it's weeks, maybe it's months, but here after the resurrection, we find the disciples back home in the backwaters of Galilee, not in Jerusalem. And they are fishing, which is how Jesus found them. Did they go back to their old ways? Did Peter just need the space to take it all in? Did they simply need to eat? Well, no matter the reason, what comes clear is that Peter actually is the fulcrum in this story. For it's Peter who leads them fishing. And it's to Peter that the beloved disciple shares his recognition of Jesus on the beach. And it is Peter who, in a mystery lost to the ages, decides to actually put on his clothes to jump into the lake and swim to shore. All to get to his master and teacher as soon as he possibly can. And it's Peter who hauls in the fish. Can't you just see when Jesus says, bring in the fish, just this exuberance of Peter sprinting to the boat and straining to haul that heavy net to shore. And it seems that because of Peter, that they are invited to share in Jesus' meal cooked over a charcoal fire. A charcoal fire. Does anybody remember the last time we heard about a charcoal fire? When was that? On Friday. For those who've been following the story closely in John's Gospel, this detail rings a bell because the last time that Peter was around a charcoal fire in this gospel was in the courtyard the night of Jesus' interrogation on his way to execution. And around that charcoal fire, Peter is asked whether or not he is one of Jesus' disciples. Wasn't he there that night in the garden? And not once, twice, but three times Peter denies that he follows Jesus of Nazareth. And then the cock crows, and Peter's denial is complete. Three times around a charcoal fire. Our scene now is around a charcoal fire. And it's what I believe is the beating heart of this chapter and part of why these early followers of Jesus just needed to tell this story. Because once more, Peter is asked three times about Jesus. Except that this time, it's the resurrected Jesus who asks, Simon, son of John, do you love me? There and hear this question. And the first time that he's asked, I can imagine Peter responding so earnestly,
yes, Lord, you know that I love you. The second time, I imagine that you might begin to wonder. It's the third time, though, that you can almost hear the desperation in Peter's voice. Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Again, why do we tell this story? What might those communities that emerged from Peter's faith, what might have been so important that they needed to tell this story? Why did these early Christians need to hear it? And why do we need to tell it today? Well, what if we were to use the lens of this paired narrative of Ananias and of Saul and look at this encounter on the shores of Lake Tiberias? What might Jesus' return to question Peter, what might it reveal? Well, I wonder if it reveals this, that the essential pattern of our lives as humans, as created of the Creator, is that no one will ever be left behind. That even as we deny and we desert, even as we turn away our gaze, even as we pretend as if our kin only extends as far as the branches of our family tree, that in truth we cannot live this life apart from one another. Christian, Muslim, atheist, agnostic, Republican, Democrat, green, libertarian, urban, suburban, rural, somewhere in between. We cannot live this way without the other. I wonder if we tell these stories today about Saul and Ananias and Peter and Jesus so that we remember. That we remember about this third way, this Jesus way, this way that always points to reconciliation one with another. Even when we cannot imagine how people could possibly believe what they believe or vote the way they vote. Even when people are breathing threats and murder. Even when it feels that our very humanity is at stake. Even then, friends, we are called to walk this road to a street called Straight and to a meal around a charcoal fire. Because when we walk this road, we cannot walk it alone.